Hi, I'm Beth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Beth.
I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
And I've been on retreat all weekend, and Karen's had the flu.
So here we are.
Here we are. I am, like, no makeup. Like, I wanted to take a nap, but I couldn't fall asleep, and I'm sure you're...
And she keeps backing away from me.
Yeah, don't get
this.
Me sick.
So we will do our best.
We'll do our best. So
we always do our best.
Yes, we always do our best. That varies from day to day. So
It does.
So last week we talked about step one, and oh my God, it was only last week.
It was only last week.
It's been a long week.
We got through chapter two.
Yep. And now, we got through There's a Solution. So tonight we're going to try to cover more about alcoholism and maybe get through part of how it works up to step three. Maybe we can get up to step
three. Have those big goals. Go, baby.
I'm sorry?
Have big goals. Go for it.
Go? Yeah?
Yeah.
I have big goals. I'm tenacious. Tenacity. All right. So, more about alcoholism. So, technically, we're still in step one. As anybody that wasn't here for the first 2 weeks, we started with step two because the entire theme of our talk through the weeks is going to be to lean in, right? So, the whole idea behind lean in is it's I'm not free enough, right? Everything looks like it's fine. I'm kind of floating through life. Everything's good. But lean in. So I actually did a fifth step this weekend with one of my sponsees who's from PA. Was there.
Nice.
Yeah, it was good to see her. And she's got in the teens. She's got some time in the teens, right? So it was like a piece of an inventory. And I'm big on lean in. I don't shy away from stuff. So we finally sat down and we started going over the inventory, and it was a couple of this and a little bit of that. And then we're sitting there, and I'm watching her go over a resentment from something that was multiple years ago, like in her, like 20 something years ago. And I'm watching her, and in my mind's eye, I keep seeing a core issue race across the front of her head and on her forehead. And I'm watching her eyes dart it away every single time. And I looked at her, and I was like, whatever's going on, it's right here. You're just not saying it. I said, are you pushing it away? Or are you not aware that it's keep floating through your head? And so we kind of sat for a second, and she had this, like, breakthrough, and she started crying, which is where most people are like, it's okay. It's going to be okay. And I was just like, all right, well, we're there. What is it? And, like, 30 seconds later, she dumped something that she realized she had been making life decisions for the last 20-something years based on a delusional lie she had 20-something years ago. Something happened to her 20-something years ago, and she has continually lived. And she kept telling me afterwards for the rest of the weekend, I really thought I had dealt with that issue. I really thought I had healed from that issue. And the entire weekend, I'm like watching her process the last 20-something years since this event to this day in 2019. And she based it her entire life decisions off of a delusional lie, off of something that happened 20-something years ago. And I kept telling her, it's not going to be fun. It's not going to feel good. And it's going to suck. But you can process out in the next days and weeks your entire life and all of the consequences from what's happened to you are going to flash before you. You can either acknowledge and let them go, or you can start to stuff it back down and go back to the delusion that you lived in yesterday. And I asked her, I said, lean in on it. Just let it's not going to kill you. It's going to feel like you're in the abyss and you're never coming back, but lean into it and you will come out of it. And this has happened to me multiple times of going through the steps. So here we are. We're asking you to lean in. If you think that nothing's wrong, do the bedevilments exercise for 5 days, right? So it's on page 53, 52. I don't know. Where's the bedevilments?
Oh, look.
Let's see.
They are on 52.
52. So the bedevilments are the bedevilments on 52. Sit with that in quiet in your evening, morning meditation, whenever you can get, like, centered, for the most centered you can get for the day. Sit with that for 5 to 15 minutes every day. ask yourself these questions and really find out, where could you be leaning in on? Where am I missing the mark? Where could I be better than I am? Where am I still in pain and don't want to acknowledge it? Where's the wool pulled over my eyes and I'm comfortable? So we talked about...
I think Beth brings up a really good point, because it's happening so much in my life right now. When we see somebody in pain, and, you know, we come in here in a lot of pain. And if you start doing the work and you start uncovering all that stuff, I mean, it's a painful journey. But we have this, like, knee-jerk reaction. When we see somebody in pain, we want to fix it. We want to make them feel better. We want to soothe it. Like Beth saying, she sees, you know, her sponsees start crying and just letting her do that. You know, I was a psychologist for 20 years, and one of the things I never did in group work was keep a box of tissues. Because if you want to stop somebody from feeling what they're feeling, the second they start crying, hand them a tissue. Because basically you're saying stop crying or stop feeling it, but you just stop that process. It's just that whole leaning in is that I trust enough that whatever is coming up, I haven't dealt with it, because I know when I showed up on Beth's doorstep, I was like, I've done these steps, I've done this work, I've processed this, I don't have any of that. And really believing that, but, you know, well, gee, wonder why I keep relapsing. So it's just trusting that where you need to go once you build, especially once you build a spiritual base, that whatever needs to come out will come out. And when it does, whether it's you or somebody that you're close with, let it come out. You know, my fiance, I never know what to call
your Fred.
My Fred. You know, it's 3 weeks now since he lost his son, and I watch people, myself included. He is in such a pain that I've really never witnessed this close, and I want to fix him. I want to make it better, and so does everybody around him. I cannot believe. And it's loving and it's kind, and I get that, but it stifles his process of grieving. And if he doesn't grieve this, his life will be a mess basically forever. So just letting somebody be where they need to be, whether that's angry or frustrated, or that whole thing we talked about, the swimming, just being out there and kind of thrashing the arms until you can find that calmness. But that takes that leaning in and trusting. And it's kind of like, you know, how happy do you want to be? You know, Beth always called it the and, because I would say I work the steps, and she's like, and? Like, in what, you know? And the more you live in this program and work this program, it's endless. I mean, there's just no end. So let it be,
let it
flow.
I mean, and it's hard on both ends. It's hard to be in that spot, and it's not easy to watch somebody crumble in front of you. You want them to feel better.
Yeah, but if I pick them up and put them back together, which my ego says that I should and I can and I don't know how to fix this, I also send him the message of, you're incapable of getting through this and you're weak to begin with. I mean, I went through all this watching my son grow up and enabling him in all kinds of ways. And every time I fixed it, I sent the message of, you're not capable of fixing it anyway, so you need me to fix it. So what kind of messages do I want to send him, whether he knows that or not, that, you know, you will get through this, you are safe and you are okay, and my behavior needs to support that, meaning that I'm not going to stand there like you're going to fall and I better be there to catch you, as hard as it is.
Yeah. So tonight we're going to finish out more about alcoholism, and then next week we're going to jump into step 3. Because we did agnostics. I don't know. We'll talk about it later.
We did it.
So chapter 3, more about alcoholism. One of the first things I have highlighted that helped me really understand the crux that I am an alcoholic is in the middle of the first paragraph, it says, the idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing, right? So I'm always in some illusion or delusion. And illusion is me looking out, or a delusion is me looking out. I don't know. Smarter people than me know the difference between the two, but you should look it up. Anyway, I didn't have a long drinking career, and so for me, I still to this day sometimes think the thought will cross my mind. Maybe I was just a traumatized teenager. I was just young. I got sober when I was 17. I wasn't even old enough to drink yet, and I was like, maybe I was just a effed up kid. And then I read this sentence and I think about my drinking and I think about before I got stuck into the system and after I got stuck in the system and what that looked like. I enjoyed my drinking very much so, and it did not go well. But when I got caught, I couldn't stop drinking, so I had to manipulate and control my drinking, which went as deep as I could cognitively allow it to. So it was, you know, well, I got to go to school, so I got to drink, but I can only drink until noon. But today I can drink till 3 because I don't have to be to aftercare till 4:30, but my mom can't come and they can't take urine on me unless my mom's in the bathroom with me. So today I can drink as much, you know what I mean? But I can't be sloshed when I go, but I wasn't happy. I couldn't find that release. You know that when you take that first drink, you get that... I would get that a little bit, but then I was like, "Oh, because if I just let it go, I'd be passed out at school again." So, controlling and enjoying is something we were never able to do. Because when I enjoyed it, I couldn't control the amount I was going to take. I passed out wherever I fell asleep or ran out of alcohol. And if I controlled it, I was not having fun.
I've never noticed that word enjoy in there. That's really interesting.
Really?
Oh, yeah, all about the controlling in that, but not the enjoying. Yeah, I've never picked up on that. And, you know, by the time I got here, there was nothing fun about the way I drank and threw substances in my body. Oh, my gosh, the enjoyment was gone so long ago. But to pick up and think that same, I mean... Yeah, I always think about the controlling, but you know that buys into that that total insanity thinking. It'll be different this time, and I can sit at the bar and I can have fun and I can be full of dignity and grace as I fall off that stool, and I won't look like I did last time. And wow, I've never. Yeah, so ask yourself, how much did you enjoy it before you got here? That's a really interesting question.
Well, you could either enjoy or control, but you can do both at the same time, right? It's that. So here we are in AA, and it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. And I believe that this holds true for me in every area of my life, that if I, my personality type, if I don't buy in 100%, I'm not really bought in at all. It's like, it kind of goes along that half measures will avail you nothing. Like, if you don't have 100% of my attention, I'm not paying attention at all. If I'm not completely convinced this is the most awesome company on the face of the earth, I'm not really going to do my job. If I don't think that you're the most amazing man on the face of the earth, this marriage is never going to work. And it's the same with my alcoholism. I was not able to concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic until I did. And I wish there was a... formula.
Yeah.
And I
wish you only get there when you get there.
When you get there.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of big book thumpers that I know will tell you, if you go through this book and you go through a thorough reading with a sponsor through the 164, by the time you get to step 2, you will concede to your innermost self. But my reality was I conceded to my innermost self the day before I got sober and didn't go through the book until I had 6.5 years. So, again, like, I don't know, this last couple years, I've been debunking this book in the fact that it is responsible for my recovery, because it's not. God's responsible for my recovery. This book is responsible for my awesome quality of life. And my quality of life is, it really is freaking awesome. But it's not responsible for the fact that I'm sober. So in order for me to stay sober, in order for me to get cracked open enough to stay sober, I really have to concede that this is who I am. And I remember that moment the night before I got sober, and it didn't come from me, but I responded to it. And I cracked open just enough for grace to get in, and I got to get sober. Is that a sentence? Is that a real thing? Like, I got to get... I got. Does that make sense?
Oh.
It makes sense. I don't know if it's real English. Anyway, I can't speak the words of the language we all. Yeah. Okay, all of us at times, all of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but still, but at such intervals, even usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led to, in time, to pitfall and incomprehensible demoralization. And this really talks about those last 3 to 4 months that I was drinking. Was like this kind of like free fall. I got away from everybody that was like, you know, giving me urines and putting me in treatment and, you know, trying to arrest me and stuff like that. And I kind of went to the other side of the country, and I had this like this very fast paced, like, oh, I can drink and I'm okay. Oh, nope, overshot the mark. Okay, start again tomorrow. I think it might have been like every single day where I thought I was good. I was doing all right. I'm doing okay. And then I would overshoot the mark. And as soon as I would overshoot the mark, immediately would go, well, screw it. I'll just try again tomorrow. So I was all about, yes, I am gonna, you know, I'm gonna get a little tipsy. I'm just gonna have a little bit. Oh, I've overshot the mark. Oh, I'll just try tomorrow. Like, I just no defense. Absolutely no defense on my part. As soon as I conceded that I would just overshot the mark for the day, you know, Pollyanna, try again tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And the more I try to control, the less I can control it, which tells me it was just out of control to begin with. I just became aware of it as I tried to control it. You know, it starts like sending up signs like you're this is so beyond you. And it italicizes the word in the book. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. Not sometimes, not someday, ever.
It says a little further down, over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And I experienced this in recovery. If I'm not taking care of my spiritual health, I get worse. I don't get better. I become crispy and dry. People are like, I'm surprised you haven't burst into flames yet. I have to consistently remind myself and everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that this is a conditional program. That God's love for you and God's love for me is unconditional. But the way of life that I get to live today through this work is conditional. If I don't do the work, I don't get to stay well. It's like we're like men. I don't really like this, but it says we are like men who have lost their legs and never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of a treatment that shall make alcoholics like other men or women. We've tried every imaginable remedy, and since some instances we get relief, but we don't get recovery. It gets worse when we relapse. We're in and out. For me, I had that brief year of being introduced to the fact that, Beth, you're an alcoholic, and I was like, no, I'm not. So I had that year of kind of like doing this, up and down, up and down, up and down, hit a bottom, came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and continued for the next 6 years to exhaust every means of managing my recovery, every means of staying sober, or every means of living a recovered life without God. Not because I had a resentment against the book, because I didn't know that this was available to me. So, or I wasn't ready, whatever. But it wasn't conscious. It goes on to talk about all the methods we've tried. We don't like to pronounce anybody alcoholic. You can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking. And that was like basically the last year of my drinking. Though there's no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. I could not. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there's still time. It goes into the retired guy, which I always find is more and more important to my story the longer I stay sober. Because he basically saw that he had some characteristics of being one of us when he was younger, so he quit. And basically, it doesn't really talk about his family in the story. It talks about his job. Mm-hmm. And it almost, like, in 2019, I'm like, wow, did you babysit your own kids? Like, did you, right? Did you ever, like, were you home by 5 o'clock? Like, ever? Were you a part of your family? Because it sounds like the only way he could maintain physical sobriety was to just barrel through.
Work.
And then he retired. He pulled out his slippers, picked up a drink, and was dead within, what, 3 years? 5 years? Well, does anybody remember? 55. Just, yeah. Four? Of course, I didn't have either number right. And that's my life. Welcome to my life. And I wonder why I make my numbers every week at work. I don't know how to do that. Anyway, then it goes into young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think they can stop as he did on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can because none of them will really want to stop. Hardly any of them because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired. He can find will find he can win out. Several of our crowd, many of 30 or less, women of 30 or less, had been drinking only a few years, and they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking for 20 years. You know, the only difference between somebody that gets sober young and somebody that gets sober old is the time.
Yep.
Is the time. And there's no difference. And I remember getting sober at a very young age. There were some old, I mean, when I got sober, there were still mostly old guys in the rooms. There's some really awesome ladies, thank God. But they would look at me like, what are you doing here? And then they started listening to my story. And I'm very grateful, although nobody up there was really working the book, I'm always grateful for the fact that they were like, they took the time to hear me and acknowledge that the words and the experiences that were coming out of my mouth were the exact same words and experiences that came out of their mouths. They just caused more wreckage. And I stuck with people. There was a couple of people that were mad at me for getting sober so young because they had caused so much more wreckage in their life. They were just really jealous or bitter. But the people like that really took the time out to love me to death, as I like to call it now, but they heard me. They knew that I would just, the wreckage, the wake of my wreckage would go as far as theirs if I went back out there.
And anybody can do that. I mean, yeah. You can talk yourself out of every meeting, every alcoholic sitting in front of you in a conversation, or you can relate to what they're talking about, because it really doesn't matter, sex, age, how you grew up, where you grew up. But if you get down to what brought you here, it's, we're the same.
Yep. This is Jim. Hold on. The Jaywalker. We're not up to the Jaywalker. Whiskey and milk. Oh, yeah. This is like one of my favorite stories.
It is a good one.
It's so fun.
I know.
So on page 35, is it 35 in your book?
Yep.
Jim. 35. We're going to talk about the whiskey and milk guy, Jim. Our first example, we'll call him Jim. I don't have, this book isn't as highlighted and outlined, so I kind of have to work on my memory. But I love it. In the third full paragraph on 35, it talks about, we told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we found. He made a beginning, right? Which to me sounds like he got to like the fourth step. Or he made a beginning. Like, actually, I think it's the third step where it says you've made a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's referring to the third step. His family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman for a business that he had lost through drinking. Which, dude, that's just not humble. That's humiliating. That's not humbling. That's humiliating, right? All went well for a time, which means he was pushing through, right? He was forcing it, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times. On each of those occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic. He knew he'd faced another trip to the asylum if he did it again. Moreover, he was going to lose his family, yet he got drunk again. And we asked him to tell us our story. And I love, Chris Schroeder brought this up at a meeting years ago. It said, I came to work on Tuesday morning. Not Monday. Yeah. I'll never forget that. I had read this story 100 times, and he goes, yeah, not Monday. And I was like, oh, my God. I remember feeling irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern that I once owned. So his pride was still alive and well. As funny and challenging as it is, I'm asking you in this moment to lean in and find where you do these things. Because that's what I do when I read this. I'm like, oh, yeah, I did that last Tuesday. Oh, that was this morning. Yeah, okay. Well, it just all happened to this guy on one day. I had a few words with my boss, but nothing serious. How do you know know it wasn't serious. Did you tell him to F off and just thought it was funny? Because I don't think my boss would appreciate that. But I would think it was a big deal. Then I decided to drive into the country to see my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where there was a bar. Bad idea. I had no intention of drinking. Shocker. I thought I would just get a sandwich.
Yep.
Right? That mm-hmm. sounds like a brilliant plan.
I never my, had the intention.
I love my brilliant plan. I have brilliant plans, too.
Me, too.
I also had the notion, which is really code for getting confused between my pride's voice and my God's voice. I had the notion that I might find a customer at the car's place, which was familiar because I'd been going to it for years. So he's going to one of his watering holes. That's awesome.
Yep.
I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. Everything's fine. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, right, that couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. Because the molecules of dairy milk coat the molecules of alcohol.
And he's got a full stomach.
And he's got a full stomach.
You know.
I vaguely sensed I wasn't being any too smart, which I don't even think that's correct English, but felt reassured because, I mean, I was taking the whiskey on some milk.
Yep.
I do this all the time. I justify my behavior by something as ludicrous as, I'm going to be fine because the whiskey's in the milk and the milk is, you know, I don't know what the milk is. It's like magic milk? I don't know.
I never found it. So
I didn't do it, but, and that sounds gross anyway.
It does sound gross.
Ugh. But we do this all the time. We justify sick behavior by coming up with a delusional lie and wrapping it up. Like, that makes perfect sense. This is why we do a 10th step. Because in the moment, I am right, you're wrong. That gives me justification for, I don't know, maybe ripping your face off, keying your car, not paying my rent, sending the bill in late, taking the day off of work, taking an extra half an hour for my lunch, because I've completely justified it. But it's really interesting because if you pause, right, it talks about in the 10th step in the big book, if you pause, right, ask God to get involved, God's like your first defense. Yet, you know, you still think it's a good idea, yet maybe call somebody and run it by somebody. Can I tell you how many times that I don't even get words over the phone? I just get laughter. People, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
No, that's an awful idea.
Sometimes you just need to say it out loud to hear yourself, and you go, that's not a good argument.
I've done that a couple of times.
Not.
Yeah, you pick up the phone and you're like, yeah, so I'm going to put some whiskey in the milk and then drink. Never mind.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, no, that's a bad idea. You just delete this message.
But if you don't stop it, you don't get God involved, if you're not leaning in, you will, pretty soon
you're
this
done.
Becomes your truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's what happens to our alcoholic brains. We tell ourselves something enough times, and it becomes our reality. And it's so distorted that I would sit here and I would swear to you. I mean, I'd pass a lie detector test because I believe what I am saying.
Yeah.
I have no defense on my own. It'll get there. And I, like Beth, can do it in everyday life. Oh, and when I have to argue with myself and convince myself that my, you know, just obnoxious behavior is totally rational and totally justified, you know, that's a ding, 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 ding. But on my own, I just think, oh, that's a pretty bell.
And yeah, and it's like, listen, most of us in this room have been through the work, have time, and are living our lives joyously most of the day. And if everybody in this room has a moral line, and if taking an extra 20 minutes on your lunch hour because nobody's going to know the difference is not going to bother you because it's not where your moral line is, I don't care where your moral line is. I care that you care where your moral line is. And if taking that extra 20 minutes on your lunch break is going to go to your shame-based personality or your guilt-based personality, or you're just going to know in the back of the head that, you know what, you're going to walk in and it's going to bug you for the rest of the day, like, did anybody notice? Does anybody know? Like, you're not on your God game. I can't be who I am. I have a shame-based personality. I got more trauma in my background than most people, and it's just when I do something wrong, I'm ashamed of myself. The longer I stay sober, the more narrow my road of recovery gets, the less I can kind of like just say, screw it, I'm just going to do the wrong thing. It's not that big of a deal. It's not like I'm putting whiskey in milk.
And when you do the little things and find a way to make them okay, don't think for a minute that somewhere down the road, something that's a little bigger that you would have not been able to make okay, but now that you can make little things not so wrong, then it's easier to make this not so wrong. And I just know this from personal experience. You know, little lies, and, you know, like a lie is a lie. But if it was something that was so trivial, but I knew it, but I got away with it, then the big lies became easier to do. When I came back from the halfway house, this popped in my head. This is so clear. I forgot about it. When I came back from the halfway house, get my first job somewhere within that first year, because I've been institutionalized for like 9 months at that point. Anyway, I'm working at the diner in town, and one day I remember I don't have Sweet and Low at home. Oh God. And I guess I don't stop at the store. So I just wanted to take some from work. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the kind of stuff I used to do. It didn't matter where I work, but sticking something in my pocket. Now, like, you know, if I go home with a pen, and it's funny, this it does say Vicky's Diner on it, but I was given this. Good example, right? Oh my God, I can't make that up, right? I have like 10 in here too. Oh God.
That was awesome.
That is funny, right? I asked my boss, I said, can I take home some Sweet and Low packets? And he looked at me like I had 10 heads. Like, that is such a weird, and I'm like, well, I wouldn't take something from here. And he wouldn't have cared at all, but I have that kind of brain that, like, it would have bothered me. And I would have known it was wrong. And when I would have used the Sweet and Low in my coffee, I would have defended it. Now, see, if I can do those things, and pretty soon I'm sitting in some bar having a glass of milk and thinking, a little whiskey in there is okay. I mean, that's how this brain, so it's like,
yeah.
You know, I'm either living a spiritual life or I'm not. There's not a lot in the middle of the road.
There's no middle of the road.
Or there's none.
You're either doing this deal or you're not.
I say there's a little.
For me, I had a procedure Tuesday night. The doctor told me, yeah, most people get this and go back to work. And then, like, the next day, I was, like, immobile. So I called and I just talked to another doctor, a woman doctor, and she's like, oh, no, you're out for, like, 2 days, Beth. Like, you just call in sick. My boss is in Aruba. She doesn't even have access to her phone. And the person I'm supposed to report to is a guy. So I called my clinical director at my site. And I was just like, Stacey, I'm not calling Dan with this. But I told her what happened. And she's like, Beth, you don't have to tell me. Just take the day. I was like, no, I need to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Or yeah. I won't be able to lay here and rest. Because it'll just be like, whatever.
Yep.
So anyway, it goes on to say that the experiment went so well that he had another one, and we all know what happens. Another trip to the asylum for what? Jim? Is this Jim? Yeah. He has much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. You can know, you probably all know this book better than me. But knowledge isn't going to keep you sober. The book isn't going to keep you sober. Writing inventory isn't going to keep you sober. It's about having a genuine experience with this world and with my higher power in order for me to stay sober. That's what's required. I took a girl through the book. To this day, we're still friends. She lives in the city. She's totally fine. She went through this book like a scholar. She showed up with inventory, with a binder, and an accordion folder, and it had tabs. I know some of you are in here. And she drank because I used to do a second step. I sometimes still do the second step exercise where I'm like, tell me everything you know about God. Tell me how you experience God, and tell me how you want to experience God. And it's just like an assignment. You can do any. It's not from the book. It's just something that just kind of move into for people that have like some weird block, whatever. She literally went to every dictionary that she could find and gave me textbook definitions for spirituality, God, like every word. For like all that stuff, but there was no experience. She was literally keeping it here so that she drank. So knowledge isn't going to keep us sober. And the next story in here is the jaywalker, right? Does everybody know the jaywalker? Does anybody not know the jaywalker? Because I can read the jaywalker because it just gets funny after a while. but it literally, it's a great way for us to kind of laugh at how normal people look at us.
Yeah, how we look to our families, I mean, yeah. Or our friends, or coworkers. I mean, everything on the line, you know, your life, your health, your finances. I mean, every aspect, and we go out and we drink again. Yeah. I mean, it has to be, you know, I just call them earth people, you know. I mean, my family, like, would just, those big blinks, like, they just couldn't, like, how could you do that? You know, I mean, yep. And there you are, the jaywalker.
Right. So after the jaywalker, it says, but for the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on a basis of self-knowledge. So this isn't the deal. No, you're good. Okay. Down on the bottom of 41, I have it highlighted, so I wonder what it says. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over the evenings in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, that I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would only give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. And what I learned from alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from the moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower, self-knowledge would not help me in those strange mental blank spots. I woke up. I was at an AA meeting, I was at the Sunday 3 o'clock AA meeting, the Evergreen Group in Sussex County. I was 16. And I was talking to Pat, and he was like, you know, going, you know, how you doing? I'm like, yeah, everything's fine, and I'm going to school tomorrow. And, you know, he's like sober a million years. He's just like, all right, great. Yeah, the next thing I remember doing is sitting in front of a campfire with a beer in my hand. I, to this day, don't know how I got there. Don't know who drove me. Well, Gary was there, so he must have drove me. But I don't remember. I don't remember what the conversation was. I don't remember if I hemmed in. I had no freaking clue. I woke up in front of a campfire with a beer in my hand. I have no mental defense against the first drink.
I had a really similar situation. I finished like a 90-day program and had to go back and forth for outpatient. And cannot tell you what happened, but somewhere on this going every day, everything is good. My family's feeling good and all of this. I woke up in the morning, there was a small little fifth or whatever, I mean, or I don't know, whatever you call the little ones, and I had a blackout the night before. I don't remember stopping and buying it. I don't remember the process of thinking. I mean, I literally was, you know, I was pleased and knew my partners. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. You know, that's how. So it's not just about when life is troubled and, oh my gosh, and I know to hang on tight, you know. Alcoholism doesn't care, you know. Cunning, baffling, powerful. It doesn't care if you had a good day or a bad day.
Doesn't matter.
Happy day or sad day. Yep.
And I think that this is part, like I've said for many, many years, I always feel like I'm a walking dichotomy. I feel like that most of the people that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous can always see both sides of the coin. We can always argue both sides of the argument. We can see the conservative and the liberal side of every single issue in our lives. No matter where we stand, we can usually stretch ourselves to see both sides of everything. And the reason for that is because we might need to manipulate the other side or my side, or I might need to know because I need to get what I need and so I can get drunk. I really do believe that there is a part of us that we keep from ourselves and we don't fully become present in our souls and in our who we are as people and with all of our thoughts of thinking until we combine that with a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. So if we're not in line with a way of life that consists of a spiritual center, we're constantly working against ourselves, which takes all of our energy. And the alcoholism's going to win because the alcoholism completely accepts me as I am and yeah. wants both sides. So, and I know that sounds like split personality kind of weird stuff, but I don't know how else to explain it. I don't know how Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of stuff. Like, it kind of alludes to it in the book. It doesn't, it's not a straight big book, but it's like, that's my experience. My mom asked me when I was 14, she goes, I really think you have split personality disorder. You're like a completely different person. And I remember going upstairs to my bathroom and staring at my face for over an hour. I might have been drinking. And in the bathroom, trying to see this other person, and then just I've never forget it. I remember I don't think I've ever shared that with anybody before, but like I remember going like this on each side, and it was like one of those three mirrors, and I was looking at the two, and I was like going like this, trying to make her come out.
It's why I have such a hard time, and I have to really work at it, and it grows as my spiritual relationship grows. It's just being present, staying here, listening to you, looking at you, hearing what you're saying without having this whole thing going on in my head, because my alcoholic brain always needs another side, needs a way out. What I mean, and it's trained to do that. I don't think that, like, how do I need to manipulate Beth at this moment? What do I need to do to sound right or to sound better? I mean, that's the just my brain would do that. And when I'm doing that, I'm not present. I don't hear what you're saying. I'm missing the moment. And it's as it's been clearly shown to me through my own experiences and was told to me for a long time, which I couldn't get, is that the only place you're with God is in the moment. Because, you know, and I think Beth brought that up last week. It's not in yesterday. It's not in tomorrow. If you want to feel God, if you want to live a God-centered life, you have to be in the moment. And I just couldn't do that because the three mirrors. I mean, I was just so many things at one time instead of just being. And it sure is a lot easier. Good God. Right? Whew. Some exhausting stuff that, you know, we went through and...
And go through.
You know, it's really interesting. In sobriety. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. It's, you don't have to come to meetings for the rest of your life. You really, I don't buy into that. I just don't. I think that you need, what I need to do is maintain a relationship with my higher power. And I have to be consistent. I'm like the least consistent, you know this. I'm the least consistent person on the face of the earth. But the one thing I need to do is make sure that I have those bases covered, because I will fall out of the ability to differentiate the true from the false of that. And for no reason.
And we're screwed. I mean, when that happens, we're, you know, there's no leaning in. We've leaned out.
Hey, Belle! I mean, that basically, so I mean, we're pretty much done like a little bit early. I'd much rather hear about everybody's kind of well-rounded first step experience.
Yeah, before we jump into the next one.
Taking into consideration that there's the physical malady, there's the mental obsession, and then there's the spiritual malady. Spiritual. Oh, wow, I can't speak English.
It's a malady.
Yeah. But... there's three parts to this, and I think that this is why it takes up, right, 43 pages is all step one. The first 43 pages, and then add in the doctor's opinion, is all step one, is because we really need to concede all of it. We really need to revisit it often, and we really need to be able to wrap our heads around, this is who I am, right? I can't shift and I can't move through until I know where I am. And these first 43 pages or whatever I just said is the best way to really truly understand my mind, my body, and my spirit. All of it is affected by this disease and none of it escapes.
And, you know, great questions to ask yourself, talk about with your sponsor, with your, you know, your friends in this program. You know, what does concede look like to you? What does that mean? Have you conceded? Because, you know, I could tell you I was an alcoholic. In fact, that was just one of the, you know, the cards I would play to keep you off my back so I could keep doing what I was doing. but conceding. I mean, it's, you know, it's like a deeper level than surrender. And for me, the way that I know if I've conceded or not to anything, you know, especially my alcohol, is look at my behavior. It'll show you every time. It doesn't matter what my mouth is saying, but what am I doing? Does what I'm doing reinforce that, yes, I know I'm an alcoholic, and, you know, those first steps, my life has become unmanageable, and the insanity, and then this higher power. Do my daily disciplines, does my lifestyle demonstrate that? Because I can convince myself of anything, but does my behavior reinforce it?
Right.
Yep.
Okay. So that's it.
Yeah. I'll open it up and hear what you guys have to say.